Tales of devastation and loss are only now coming to the fore in New South Wales as local landholders are able to survey the damage from this week's fires. Evacuation points have popped up all over the mid-north coast and the north coast, and they've been vital rest and regeneration points for a number of landholders and townspeople who have lost everything. Our Port Macquarie rural reporter Michael Kavanagh spoke on the New South Wales Country Hour earlier this week.
I'm at the Wingham Showground, where you and I broadcast a number of times from outside the Beef Cattle Pavilion, and I'm just across from that at the tea rooms of the Wingham Showground, and that's where people are gathered. In fact, they've just brought out morning tea. There's fruit, there's cake for the people that have been left homeless, not just those, but also the local land services that are providing support, advice and what to do with fodder, because this was one of the areas where people that had animals, particularly large animals, Condo, that brought them initially when the fires really hit on Saturday.
And roughly how many people would be there?
That I'm not too sure at the moment, because they're coming and going during the day. Some are trying to get out, for example, to Bowen, which was absolutely belted by the fires. It lost its school and everything around it. They had to move people yesterday. In fact, the only people that are allowed to be in the showground now are those that have got their stock and larger animals with them, because yesterday the threat was that bad, even around Wingham. The authorities said, look, you've got to move, and a lot of them went into Taree at Club Taree, which has become a big evacuation centre for people staying overnight. The people here are those, the ones that have got their animals. The tea rooms here, there are tables that are absolutely laden with donated clothing that's been brought in, because some people just got nothing. What they were wearing on the day they fled the fire, that's what they've still got. There's been meals cooking. There's a woman here who's been overseeing the cooking, and she's just essentially been staying here, cooking any of the fires that come in, local land services. She said, Kylie said that she reckons she's done about 200 meals since Saturday, mainly egg and bacon rolls and scrambled eggs. At one stage, one of the people that lost everything picked up his meal and he looked at it and he said, geez, I wouldn't mind a beer. She got on Facebook and posted this. Next moment, seven slabs were brought into the Wingham Showground. So they've got this behind me in the Beef Cattle Pavilion. There are pile upon pile of hay bales and utes coming in, trailers, to pick them up after they've been assessed by LLS that everything's okay.
And I would imagine there are a number of people with some terrible, horrific stories about having lost everything as well.
Oh, look, and it's interesting. You can almost pick them in the fact that they're so casually dressed, because I'd say what happened, they just grabbed anything they could get hold of to get out for safety. And so many people, you hear right across, yesterday at Wauchope, they were talking about how they wanted to get their animals out, make sure obviously their children were safe, and then the last minute would be getting themselves. And a good example of that is poor Miss Campbell. Now, his family go back 200 years in the region, and he's out at Bowen, and he kind of was out there on Saturday, left it, came back, the house is okay, and now he's literally here, he's going back out to look at his place, because he's not only lost the property, incredible links to history.
Well, Friday the fires came through and basically saw them come up over the ridge from Kapara. While myself and a neighbour were trying to do fire preparations, it just flared up. I went down the road and noticed that the flames were exploding trees from the bases up. Raced back home, sent another neighbour a text, get out, you're in the path of the fire, because their place was lower down Bowen Creek than I am. I spoke to my neighbour and said, it's time to go. He said, I'm staying a little bit longer. And I grabbed a couple of things, basically more for my daughter's sake. I didn't grab anything for myself and evacuated. And the events that happened with the school burning down and houses in the centre of Bowen happened. And we came and we thought that was over.
Your house, it was the first house in the Bowen area, 200 years old, you've been back. What's remaining?
Absolutely nothing. I've lost the house, completely burnt to the ground, shed burnt to the ground, stables, bales, all fencing. As I said, when I came back in, the chook pen was on fire and we were letting the chooks out. So the chook pen's gone, the veggie pats has gone, tractors, quads, horse tackle, from riding saddles to draft horse gear that I had inherited and purchased, and some of that stuff was over 100 years old.
Some of that gear is, for example, the family Bible. How far does that go back?
That went back, the one I had went back prior to around about the 1700s, with all the births, deaths and marriages. I've lost all memorabilia of the family, so we had medals from World War One, World War Two. I had a old 303 that was 102 years old that was still operational, that had been used by a relative in World War One. That's completely disintegrated. I had antiques dating back, at least a good 200 years.
200 years of history gone up in minutes. You've got your memories. What are you going to do?
Well, rebuild. It's a country motto, isn't it? Whether you get knocked down with regarding floods, we've had some dramatic floods out our way. It's incredible to believe that we've had dramatic floods that have kept us in there for 15 days at a time where we couldn't get out. It's hard to believe that after 3.5 years plus of drought.
How important has this, the Wingham Showground, the fact that you've been here on and off since the weekend, how important is it?
Oh, incredibly important. These guys, I believe, are doing it on their own bat. Other places might get funding, I'm not 100% sure, but these guys have been running this centre for days now, and a lot of these volunteers have not gone home. I turned up, and as I said, I had no clothes. I had been in the same clothes for 4 days. I really needed underwear and socks. They put in the call, and within 10, 15 minutes later, someone had kindly donated fresh underwear. Sorry, gets you a bit with the roller coaster. One moment you're on the sad bit, other moments you're nearly on tears because of the gratitude of thanks.
Paul Miscampbell from Wingham, that's west of Taree, sharing his story with Michael Kavanagh. The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission is nearly halfway through a big road trip around the Murray-Darling Basin. It's investigating how well our water markets are functioning against a backdrop of growing mistrust in the market. Clint Jasper was at the authorities' meeting in Deniliquin and he joins me now. Hi there, Clint.
Good morning, Ed.
So the ACCC has visited some fairly different patches along the river. What are some of the issues they have in common?
I think if we just stick with the southern basin, so the Murray and Murrumbidgee rivers are the main ones there, the Goulburn as well. If there's one thing that unites irrigators along those river systems, it's a bewilderment and alarm at how high prices have risen this year. We've seen prices hit around $1,000 a megalitre on occasion, and they're bubbling away at quite high levels that basically put them out of reach for a lot of people or really strained the budget. So there's a concern at the high prices, and there's a suspicion that it's not just a lack of supply that's pushing those prices up. So whether you're in Mildura, whether you're in Renmark, the Riverina in southern New South Wales, there's a generally held belief that, there's some mysterious power in the market that's driving those prices up. It's not just to do with the lack of water availability this season.
And when we're talking about $1,000 a megalitre, is that setting records? Is it something that we saw during the Millennium Drought? How does it kind of sit in historical context?
We did see it during the Millennium Drought, but to give you an example of just the way that the prices have jumped up, when I was in the middle of the year speaking with irrigators who just survived last summer around the Mildura Sunraysia region, the market was so sensitive that most of them had gone into summer budgeting to pay around $400 a megalitre on the temporary market. Now, there was a strong heat wave, a string of orders went in, and all of a sudden people were, they'd budgeted $400. They were suddenly being forced to pay $600 a megalitre. So it was a quite sharp jump up, and it was the same situation. It was only last month, I believe, that prices hit $1,000 a megalitre. And again, it came with some hot weather, a string of orders, and all of a sudden the price jumped up. And I think, you know, if you take the textbook definition of such constrained supply, lots of people on 0% allocation needing to buy higher security water on the temporary market. A rush of demand onto a tight supply will see prices jump up very quickly.
That's a huge escalation to $1,000 then. Mm. So in Denny and Griffith, where the ACCC has been this week, what have been some of the key concerns put forward by the audience?
I think if you are talking to irrigators above the Barmah Choke, the Murray River's narrowest stretch of river, especially in southern New South Wales, the Riverina and northern Victoria, a key concern here is the fact that by the Basin Authority's own figures, it lost around 620 gigalitres in what it calls conveyance losses, just trying to get water from the storages, Hume and Dartmouth, downstream to where it was being used in Mildura and across the border in South Australia. Now, they call these conveyance losses. It's water that's basically doesn't make it all the way down the river. It spills over the banks into places like the Barmah and Millawa Forest, and it's essentially just gone from the system. It doesn't count against anyone's ledgers. It's water. It basically is the cost of running the river. Now, it's a very bitter pill to swallow if you are a general security license holder in the New South Wales Murray, being told that there's no water available for you this season. You're on 0% allocation, and yet 620 gigalitres is being lost over the banks in order to get water downstream to users on almond or citrus plantations around Sunraysia or across into South Australia. So from what I saw in Deniliquin, until and unless that issue is solved, there's not going to be a lot of faith in the way that the market is structured right now to get water from places like the New South Wales Murray downstream. While those losses are occurring, no one's going to really have faith that the system's really operating in their favour as they watch that water get lost.
And to put it into context for us, is that a lot of water?
It is. I can't do the Sydney harbours off the top of my head. But if you put 620 gigalitres in the context of the entire basin plan recovery targets of roughly 2,700 gigalitres is what the basin plan intends to remove from irrigated agriculture and return to the environment, you know, 600 gigalitres is, you know, a significant amount of water.
It does sound like a lot. Some of the other kind of concerns that have been raised is who is in the market, who has power with buying. Did those sorts of issues come up?
Absolutely. There's a general consensus, I think, no matter where you are on the river, that the system is not transparent. What a lot of irrigators are calling for is sort of a centralized database where they can find out who's buying water, who's selling water, and who currently owns water from what area, which doesn't currently exist. You can get that info off brokers. But that drives this suspicion about who's actually in the market and why prices are doing what they're doing. I spoke with John Lolicato. He is the chair of the Walker River Association and an irrigator in the New South Wales Murray. And here's what he had to say about transparency in the marketplace.
Oh, look, we haven't got a transparent water market. If I want to go to the market and find out who owns what, I physically can't. So I think that one of the main points that came out of today is how there does need to be a transparent market where we can actually access it.
So what is the problem with market transparency now?
Edwina, you would know, as my boss approving the budget for the exercise that I undertook months ago, trying to work out who was buying and selling in the New South Wales Murray and Murrumbidgee. Essentially, New South Wales is as close as any state has to transparency, and it's about as clear as mud. You can go onto that website, you can download a list of trades. Essentially, what you get is a water access license number and what kind of volumes have been traded. You then have to pay a private information broker to find out what ABN is attached to that water access license. And, you know, you're being slugged anywhere between, I think it was $10 or $16 a search. So it's not really something that, if you don't have deep pockets, you can really do extensively and find out a large volume of these trades. So these are the kind of things that people run into when they try to analyse the water market, and that's what they are asking for when they say we want a transparent marketplace. I think it's become a common refrain as well that in addition to suspicion of large corporate players like Duxton Water and Kilter Rural, there's also a suspicion that even some politicians own water as well. And it almost doesn't matter how many times they say they don't. It's until they can see it up there, there's no water attached to their families or their personal accounts, these kind of rumours aren't going to go away. So it's hoped that the ACCC can clear up some of these issues.
And you did discover some very interesting things as part of those searches. In fact, sort of some very suggestive evidence that, you know, the face of farming in the Murray-Darling Basin is changing. But I've really noticed in this conversation about water and the Southern Basin in particular that the pitchforks are out for corporate investors, aren't they?
They really are on the ground among smaller farmers. There were a few at the Shepparton hearing. I know there were a few water brokers present. There was one of the more significant corporate players, Blue Sky, was present at the Deniliquin hearing. They bravely stood up and put their point of view, but not a lot of people wanted to hear it. I think one of the most interesting insights we've had into how corporate players work in this marketplace was last week on RN Breakfast when a client of Duxton Waters was speaking with Hamish and said that essentially because he had signed a lease with Duxton Water to buy their allocation, and he did it in advance of this price rise, he was actually paying less than the market price for water at the moment. So it had worked in his favour. But again, because the ACCC has the power to make these types of players in the markets and water brokers turn over their books, they'll be able to do a really proper and thorough analysis of just how these players operate in the market, what they do, and what kind of influence they can even have on prices. And if that can be put into a report and kind of given some sunlight, it might put some of these rumours to bed. It might even confirm some rumours, but we'll have to wait for the report to find that out. But Mick Keogh is also very keen to point out, and it's important to remember the ACCC, Australian Consumer and Competition Commission, it's got a limited scope in what it can recommend. It has to focus on competition law. So Mick Keogh was keen to point out, he's the deputy commissioner of the ACCC, he's chairing all these meetings through the basin, about just what his authority can do in this space.
Our role is to make competition work. And some people interpret that as, well, we'll just have no regulation in the market and let the market do what it will. And generally speaking, that's not the case. You have to look at markets and how they operate. If there are situations where something's impeding that market working well, then you regulate. So if we look at electricity, if we look at telecommunications, if we look at a whole range of different goods and services used by the community, those markets have regulations.
Now that's Mick Keogh from the ACCC. So Clint, what are the key deadlines in this investigation? Because it feels like there's a number of investigations and inquiries happening all at the same time.
Yes, there absolutely are. It's kind of mind-boggling to keep up with most of them. For this one, the ACCC one, the roadshow continues. The week that has just passed us was Griffith, Deniliquin, Kerrang and Shepparton. I believe they're off to the Northern Basin and will finish down in Murray Bridge next week in South Australia. The interim report is due in May next year and the final report will be handed down in November. There's a separately three others going on. Robbie Sefton is looking at a inquiry into the socioeconomic impacts of the plan. There's a separate inquiry looking at some of the water delivery issues. And there's another inquiry looking at constraints. It was interesting that John Lolicato, the irrigator we heard from just before, by his estimation, there's already been some 70 inquiries and reviews into the plan already. So he wasn't that optimistic that any groundbreaking changes were going to come from this ACCC investigation, but not losing hope that some reform can be made.
Yes, and as the drought continues and it doesn't look like there's any reprieve, water concerns are not going anywhere, are they?
They are likely to intensify. These are farmers. They love to farm. That's what they do day in, day out. They're on zero allocation. They've been left with not much to do, and they're getting quite angry at the arrangements that are putting them on 0% allocation. And like I said before, it's very bitter pill to swallow to read about the conveyance losses and water spilling over the banks as it heads downstream, and even environmental water. If you can't farm, if you can't do the thing you love, it's understandable that you're going to start getting pretty angry at whatever is preventing you from growing a crop.
And I believe we're going to see a bunch of them in Canberra toward the end of the year. Clint, some great insights into what's happening out in regional Australia. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Clint Jasper there, one of our resident water experts in the rural team. And for those curious, that amount of water lost along the way, lost in so-called conveyancing, 600 gigalitres was our comparison figure. I can tell you Sydney Harbour holds around 500 gigalitres. And for those interested in what Clint discovered when he looked into who was buying and selling water in the Murrumbidgee district of the Murray-Darling Basin, we'll put a link on our website to that story from last year. Just head to the RN homepage and look for A Country Breakfast. And that's the show for this week. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast via the ABC Listen app, where you can find all your favourite programs and live stream all our wonderful stations. I'm Edwina Farley. Great listening is right here on RN.